Today is October 3rd, and we're having Colonel Daniel Davis with us to talk about what's going on in the Middle East and in Ukraine. Let's get started. Welcome back, Colonel.
Hey, thanks for having me back. I appreciate it.
Let's get started with the conflict in the Middle East with the Iranian attack, missile attack on Israel. What do we know so far from this attack and the objective of this attack and how successful was that?
Well, I think that the objective of the attack by Iran, and you don't even have to hardly do any interpretation because the Iranians themselves told you, was to respond to the provocations that Israel has made, not provocations, but the attacks that Israel has made, where they assassinated the Ismail Haniyeh in Tehran, in the capital city during their inauguration, a very, very provocative move by Israel. And then the assassination of Hezbollah leader Hassan Nasrallah, and all of the attacks that have been going on there. So they said that this was in response for that, but they were very careful in that they don't want it to escalate. And they said, as far as we're concerned, we're done. We have responded to the attack that you did against us, and basically we consider it even. When you look at what they did, they showed remarkable restraint because there were no casualties reported other than, I think, one Palestinian, ironically, who was killed by falling debris. But no Israelis were at least reported to have been killed, even though there was some strikes on one of the air bases that's in the area there. And you see, like the video you're showing there and a bunch of others, that these missiles could, if they had fallen in the cities, it could have caused extraordinary damage and huge casualties, because despite the claims, you know, the Iron Dome, the various other elements of it, the aero system, et cetera, those things did not stop most of these missiles, as was claimed. That you're seeing right there, you saw one of those missiles was intercepted in the air. All the rest of them hit. And that, I think those are the ones of the air base that was hit. And we now have satellite imagery to show that there were, in fact, some things struck in there. But the fact that they didn't have casualties says that the Iranians specifically chose not to have a real provocative move, you know, that would have killed a lot of people, that would have necessitated some kind of response back. But they also were very clear and said, but if you respond further and if you carry this on further, our next shot will not be limited. It will be much more powerful and apparently much broader.
And how about right now? What do we know about the Israeli side and how the United States is trying to manage the situation?
Yeah, that's the right word in both cases, trying to manage, not leading, not providing any leadership here. We're being swept away by events. All the evidence, as far as I can ascertain, says that Netanyahu wants to solve all of his problems militarily. He wants to get rid of the Palestinians in the Gaza Strip. He wants to get rid of Hezbollah in Lebanon, and he wants to get rid of his arch nemesis, Iran, all in one fell swoop. And so he's obviously still fighting a war against Hamas in the Gaza Strip, even though it doesn't get much media time in the U.S. anymore. He has now physically opened up a full-scale war against Hezbollah in Lebanon, and now he's on the verge of opening a third front, actually a fourth when you count the Houthis, opening a fourth front against Iran with a big missile barrage, which I believe is calculated to draw Iran into a war so that then he can then turn to the United States and saying, oh my gosh, we can't handle a four-front war. We've got to have your help. And especially if they keep suffering more casualties in Lebanon, which they have been doing, it's not going well at the beginning there. And if they, the response from Iran after whatever Israel does next causes lots of damage and causes casualties, they'll say, we can't handle this without you. And to be true, they can't fight these wars without us. They don't have the missile interceptors. They don't have the artillery. They just don't have the stuff of just to maintain a ground war, even, because the objectives they have set in the Lebanon fight is something that would take many months, probably closer to a year, to actually accomplish the tactical objectives that they claim that they're going after. And that'll require a very substantial and sustained supply from the United States, because they can't do it on their own. So we have all, the United States has all kinds of leverage, which we could tell Israel, hell no, don't do this. You go in and fight Iran. If you start a new war, you're on your own. That we're not going to get sucked into that war. That's what we should do. And if we did, they would have to, no matter what Netanyahu wants, if he doesn't have the capacity and he knows he's not going to have the Americans fighting for him, that could probably constrain his actions. But instead, what have we done? You saw the president of the United States in front of Air Force One yesterday openly say that he hopes that they don't strike Iranian nuclear facilities. That Netanyahu won't even talk to him. One of the reporters asked him, when did you talk to Netanyahu? Well, I haven't, but I probably will here in the next few days. No, I doubt that happens because Netanyahu doesn't want to talk to him. He doesn't want him to tell him no, so he's just not going to talk to him, I think. But the other action we have done is send two aircraft carrier strike groups into the region, which tells Netanyahu, we're going to be there for you. And so if you start this war, we're going to be right there ready to launch, whether it's defensive or offensive remains to be seen. It's also of concern that the commander of the Central Command, the U.S. Central Command, as well as I saw the chairman of the Joint Chiefs of Staff, were in the office spaces of the Israeli command. I mean, that looks like it's a hand in glove kind of a arrangement, like they're actually making plans together. So all the evidence says that we are going to fight a war with Israel, even though the words say something different. And there's ridiculous claims that we want a negotiated settlement, we want a ceasefire, all this kind of stuff. But every action says we're ready to go to war.
Can we say for sure that they're going to attack? They're going to respond to Iran?
I think it's as close to guaranteed as you can get in human affairs. There's always the possibility things could change. But I mean, Netanyahu has put every credibility on the line by emphatically saying that's what's going to happen. Yoav Gallant said it was going to happen. The ambassador, Danny Dannon, said it was going to happen. And they were all using really strong adjective language about it's going to be painful, it's going to be severe, et cetera. And now all of a sudden, if they don't do it, then obviously they lose a lot of credibility. So I think that they intentionally painted themselves into a corner. Now I think they have to do something.
And we know that Biden was talking about that. You're not, for the United States, it's not acceptable to let you attack the nuclear facilities in Iran. But how do they really consider what the Biden administration is talking about?
Well, they never have. They haven't considered that in the past. I mean, remember several months back when we said, absolutely no, you cannot go into Rafah. That's off limits there. And then they just said, yeah, whatever. They went in there. We keep saying, oh, we're seeking a two-state solution. And they say, yeah, we're not. We're not going to seek a two-state solution. About a month ago that we said, hey, Israel has agreed on the terms of a ceasefire in Hamas area. And, we just need them to come to yes. And then Netanyahu goes on Fox and Friends in the United States and says, no, absolutely not. There's no deal. I mean, every time we've said something, they have repudiated and done whatever they want to do. And then we give them $8.7 billion a week ago. So you can see again with all of our actions, it doesn't matter what the words are. With our actions, we are facilitating everything that they're doing. So even though Biden says with his mouth, we don't want him to attack that, I don't see any reason why Israel won't do it unless they just choose not to.
And what's amazing that the president of Iran was talking about that the United States, in the aftermath of the assassination of Ismail Haniyeh, the United States was talking with Iran and assuring them that they're going to bring some sort of ceasefire to Gaza. And in order to convince Iranians not to attack Israel. And he was so disappointed with the policymakers in the United States, because right after that, we had the assassination of the head of Hezbollah, Syed Hassan Nasrallah, in Beirut. Here is what the foreign minister of Lebanon was talking about what was going on between the government in Lebanon and the United States considering the ceasefire.
Iran fired on Israel. I spoke with Lebanon's foreign minister, Abdullah Bou Habib, who's in Washington to meet with American officials, and he joined us for his first interview since the latest escalations. Foreign Minister, welcome back to the program.
Thank you. Thank you.
Things have reached a major crisis in your country since we last spoke. And I want to ask you are in the United States right now. You know that several of the administration officials agree with Israel's, you know, ground incursion into your country. What do you make of that as you're in Washington trying to get support for a ceasefire?
Well, they also agreed on the, you know, the Biden Macron statement that calls for a ceasefire, and that calls also the implementation for 21 days ceasefire, and then Mr. Hochstein would go to Lebanon and negotiate a ceasefire. Okay, and they told us that Mr. Netanyahu agreed on this, and so we also got the agreement of Hezbollah on that. And you know what happened since then? That was the day we saw you in New York.
I know, and you were you were talking about going into the Security Council for this ceasefire, and barely 24 hours later, the head of Hezbollah was assassinated. Are you saying Hassan Nasrallah had agreed to a ceasefire just moments before he was assassinated?
He agreed. Yes. We agreed completely. Lebanon agreed to a ceasefire, but consulting with Hezbollah, the speaker, Mr. Birri, consulted with Hezbollah, and we informed the Americans and the French that what happened.
So,
and they told us that Mr. Netanyahu also agreed on the statement that was issued by both presidents.
Yeah, come on, it's just amazing what's going on, and I don't know how we can understand, because at the end of the day, we can understand that Netanyahu and his administration are not interested in any sort of peace agreement, any sort of negotiation, any sort of ceasefire. And how do you see it right now?
Yeah, this validates my contention that Netanyahu does not want any kind of negotiated settlement, doesn't want any kind of a peace agreement. He wants a military victory. I think what he wants to do is to somehow over time get rid of the Palestinians out of Israel. And that probably will eventually even include the West Bank. But he wants to make life so miserable and so egregious to even have no hope for a possibility of ever having freedom, that somehow somebody will eventually take them. And whether it's Egypt or Jordan or anywhere else, that they'll eventually let them, they'll send them out. He does not want a peace agreement with anything that's going to leave Hezbollah still existing. He wants to destroy them. Some of his former Prime Minister Bennett actually used that term, that they want to destroy them. And that requires a ground incursion that literally invades and wipes everything out. And according to what Israel has sent out about the warnings they've given to some of the Lebanese cities that are as far as 60 kilometers away from the border. So it looks like that they're going to conquer all that territory and tell all the people to leave. Now, whether they occupy it and never give it back or whether they eventually return, that's an open debate question there. But now then he wants to go into the next one. And so he has taken every action Netanyahu has that would spawn a response from Iran so that they can do exactly what we've seen since then, is to act like, oh my gosh, this horrendous, maniacal regime in Iran has unprovoked attacked us in this terrible thing. They have made a mistake and they will pay for it. And we cannot leave this untouched. And enough is enough, as Bennett has said on many American networks. And so to American ears, they don't know what Israel did to Iran first. That part rarely gets talked about, or they just slough it off. But when Iran does something in response, then they see that as evidence that, yes, see, I told you, they're this evil, wicked empire, and they want to destroy us. They want to kill us. The only thing we can do is go to war with them and kill them first. And so that's getting a lot of traction. And so now I get to your question a minute ago. I don't see any way that Israel could have gone this far and then not made that last part, because that's the third of the triangle, if you will, of enemies that they want to vanquish. And they need America participation and support in order to do that. So I think that you're going to see something happen that's going to draw the United States into it, to where we're not just shooting down drones or something or giving Israel missiles, but that we're actively engaging in the conflict there. I think that Biden wants to avoid that, especially in a political campaign when you're like 5 weeks from the election. but his hand may be forced by what Israel's going to do, because I don't think Israel cares about the American administration and our election. They want to take, in fact, I think they want to use that as leverage to get coercion and acceptance from the U.S. so that they can do what they want to do here. That's what I think is happening. And so far, the evidence is lining up to support that. We'll see what happens next.
When we think of the timing of this attack on Lebanon and the final days of the Biden administration, and they're doing this, do you think they're doing this because whoever wins the 2024 presidential election, they want to have him in office while they're having this conflict in Lebanon? Do they want to just force them to accept this war between Israel and Lebanon?
You know, the problem is, I mean, you know, obviously President Biden is always touting his pro-Zionist, you know, pedigree, that he's been, you know, longer than anyone else has been all this pro-Zionist is Israel. But you look at Harris or Trump, and they're almost, you know, competing with one another to see who can be the most pro-Israel. So honestly, I don't think it makes any difference at all. I don't think the timing is important to Israel. I don't think it's important for the election, because both candidates are saying the same thing. So there's no daylight there.
Yeah. What do we know about the quality of these troops that Israelis are putting on the ground? Are they well prepared for this ground attack? Because in terms of when you do the air bombing, everything, it doesn't that much influence by the quality of the troops right now on the ground, because you have to fight it on the ground.
Right. And yeah, that's one of the things I've been telling a lot of people. It's Israel has unmatched air power, and because Israel at least has a good air defense capability and an unmatched air force and missile force that Hezbollah has no answer for. They can't do anything except get blown up. I mean, as we've seen. But you go in on the ground, it's a whole different ballgame, because now then the situation reverses. Now then the advantages go to Hezbollah, not to the Israelis, because they're not used to dealing with this kind of war. This is really hard stuff here. This is PhD level kind of operations we're talking about here, because you have to have really good coordination, good flank security. You've got to have a really good tactical plan. It's got to be rehearsed so that you get things in sequence and coordinated and organized. You have good intelligence, you know where the enemy is, and then that you're disciplined in knowing how to go after them. But that's not what they've gotten in Gaza City and in Rafah and all the other places they fought in that war, because basically they can do whatever they want to. There's not a lot of fire maneuver. There's not a lot of tactics. There's just blowing stuff up, whether it's with the air power, tanks, machine guns, whatever. So it's just like a blunt instrument there. But this place, Hezbollah has been spending literally more than a decade in some places since 2006 building up defenses. They've been stockpiling them with all the provisions that they would need, you know, food, water, ammunition, other kinds of things, weapons, etc., so that they don't have to have a lot of supply lines going on, and they can fight independently, so they don't need a lot of these communications, which they lost with a lot of the pager stuff. That was a problem, and it caused a lot of difficulty for Hezbollah. But when you're talking about the tactical fight, it's not much of an impact, because they didn't rely on that anyway. They can fight independently, and they already know what their plans are. And of course, nobody knows the ground better than they do. They've got booby traps built. They've got tunnels that are built. And by all accounts, they're even better than the ones that Hamas has been using. They're better equipped. And unlike Hamas, there's no fence there. So everything is wide open. They'll continue to get supplies. They'll continue to get help. They can get everything that they need. So this would be a monstrously difficult task for the Israeli Defense Forces. And if they truly have, I argue that if they even just set the Litani River as the objective, that's 25 kilometers away. And that is, and if you look on a map, you're talking about, it's about 125 kilometers wide in that part of Lebanon. That is incredibly difficult task. Just look at what the problem that Russia has had getting through the Ukrainian defenses, most of which were also built since 2014. So those were all in place before for the majority of them. They're getting to the end of that now. But you see that for the last 12 full months, Russia's basically been on an offensive, and it's been very, very slow and meticulous, taking enormous amounts of firepower. And Russia has millions of men to draw from. So even if it costs a lot in troops, they can pay that. Israel doesn't. Israel doesn't have millions of men that they can draw on because they're already, by having their reserves activated and fighting on the current war, it's caused a severe economic problem because they don't have enough people to do the work. The tourism has, you know, almost come to a stop, et cetera, that they count on. Those are all going to be exacerbated by this. I don't know how you can maintain all of the firepower that they have. And that assumes that you can, that the Americans are just going to keep giving them everything they wanted with no supply shortages, while we're also trying to do the same thing for Ukraine, who's demanding the same amount of stuff. You see that there's just a mixed match between ends and means. What Israel is saying they're trying to accomplish and what they've started trying to, and the means to get there, I just don't think they have it. And it's going to be a problem. At some point, they're going to run out of something or just run out of steam. But the other side is going to keep getting reinforced. So I don't think this works out well for Israel on any front.
Yeah, Israelis were attacking a Russian base in Syria. How is that working for this conflict between the Syrians and Israelis?
Yeah, well, you haven't heard much about Syria ever since 10/7, really. And the IDF has actually made a lot of strikes into Syria. They've assassinated people. They've attacked the airports on numerous occasions. But Syria, because of its civil war that it's been fighting forever, is very, very weak and not in a position to do much. So they haven't been able to respond very much. But when you're talking about, you know, everybody in the region, if they all turn their weapons against Israel, if it escalates into a regional war, then there's no reason for people to withhold anything. If the Syrians are attacked by Israel and, you know, and they're part of the target list, then they have no incentive to be quiet anymore. They'll do whatever they can. A lot of these militia groups that are supported by various sides, they have every incentive to do what they can against Israel, or against the American bases that are out there. And, you know, that's another issue and a vulnerability for the United States. So just every way you want to look at this, it's a bad deal for Israel and the West.
Yeah. And you've learned that Netanyahu was so desperate to talk with Putin, but he couldn't get it at the end of the day. Do we know? Because they're attacking the Russian base in Syria. And he, at the same time, he wants to talk with Putin. What was the main objective, if you were to speculate on that, and in terms of what's going on between Russia and
Israel? Yeah, look, I think that Netanyahu has vastly overestimated his capacity, and he has seen how successful he's been with the American president, and I think that he thought he could do the same thing with the Russian president. But look, Russia is an ally of Syria. They're an ally of Iran, and they need Iran to stand further. So I don't know what he's thinking. Does Netanyahu thinks that he's going to convince Putin to allow him to just go and attack into to Iran, and that there's not going to be any consequences, even though they have base? And then now that you attack a base where there are Russian troops, I mean, that's just insane. That's just ridiculous to me that he would do that and think that somehow he's going to get something good out of it. And of course, Putin didn't take the call. Obviously, he wasn't busy. He's just not going to take it because he's already, you know, trying to calculate what are they going to do in response. Because I assure you that Russia is not going to allow Iran to be defeated. He's not going to allow there to be a regime change or for the leadership to be destroyed. He's not going to do that because they need Iran. They need Iran's industrial capacity. They need them to keep on making these Shahed drones and some of these other rocket systems that are alleged that they're getting and whatever other kind of support they have. He needs that to stay open, to keep fighting his war there. So he will defend that and protect it. And if Netanyahu thinks he can talk Putin out of that, then that's weird.
And do you find that the U.S. foreign policy is just miraculously unifying Russia, China, and Iran?
yeah, that's, I would have used a different word, like pathetically, but that works. It's fecklessness, it's imbecile. I you just pick your word. It's shocking to the level to which our diplomacy has atrophied, and the lack of any knowledge or even a willingness to actually engage in genuine diplomacy. Because every one of these problems could be dealt with. We could have had a negotiated settlement, a ceasefire, and then a negotiated settlement in the Hamas fight. That could have been off the table. both Iran, the Houthis, and Hezbollah all said that if that war goes into a ceasefire, so do they. So that would have stopped the rockets coming in from Hezbollah, because none of that started until after Israel went into the Gaza Strip. So negotiations were available. People desired to have a negotiated ceasefire and then ultimately come to a peace agreement. You had the 57-member Arab League just a couple of days ago emphatically say, we're willing to guarantee Israel's security. We want there to be peace. We want Israel to have security. It's just got to be in a package deal with this one, i.e. back to the Palestinian issue. If that can just even have a hope for a future, they're all willing to bring peace to this. The only thing that's not is Israel. Netanyahu doesn't want any of that. He just wants to eliminate physically, militarily, all of his enemies in the region, or all the people he doesn't like. And he just doesn't have the resources to do it. I mean, it would be really hard if the United States Armed Forces, with all of our capacity, wanted to accomplish that task. It would be monumentally difficult. But they don't. They what is it? 8 million people in Israel, I think it is. 6 million of them are actually Jews. They're dependent on everything from us, from supplies, but they're dependent on themselves for the manpower. And even if we joined in, and I don't see any appetite in America for actually going in on the ground in any war at all. I bet if you ask some polls, because people are so pro-Israel, there probably would be some support to use air power until it starts having catastrophic effects, until you start seeing our ships be attacked and our troops being killed. That'll change then too. But nobody is going to support going in on the ground. So that means that Israel is whatever they have on the ground, whatever their ground troops have, that's what it's going to take. And that's a task. We used to have this thing when I was on active duty. It's called a troop to tasks list. And so you said, all right, here's the task I have. How many troops do I have to assign to get that task done? And whether that's a tactical thing, like take this, you know, platoon to take that stronghold, or it's a national deal, same situation. Israel doesn't have the troops or the resources to accomplish the goals that Netanyahu has now set them on. And it could still, I mean, we're in the 11th hour and 59th minute, but they haven't launched. Israel hasn't, at least as of the time we're on the air here. So it could still be called off. Israel could not respond the way they've done, and they could start seeking diplomacy even at this late hour. But the minute I believe that Israel launches something big, and especially if it has serious damage on like any oil infrastructure or kills a lot of Iranian people, then I think that the gloves are off, and I don't think anybody can stop it. Then you're just going to keep going up the rungs of the escalation ladder, and God only knows where it'll end up then. There's so many possibilities. Even I can't give you a plausible guess of where it would go after that, but my gut tells me it'll all be bad.
Yeah. And when it comes to the conflict in Ukraine, here is Ben Wallace, former British Secretary of State for Defense, is talking about his solution for the conflict in Ukraine. Here is the article. Netanyahu shows us how to win in Ukraine. Hit your enemy ruthlessly. And Colonel, when you look at this type of mindset and the way they're talking about, he has a military background. He knows what's going on in Ukraine. He understands the activities of Ukrainian, how powerful right now is Russia against Ukraine. Why he's talking this way, in your opinion?
I haven't seen the article, so I don't know what's his general argument. What is he saying there?
Yeah, here is the article. Can you see it right now?
I can see the headline, but I don't know what's inside of it.
Yeah, he's talking about the point is you have to consider the same strategy that Netanyahu is using in the Middle East. Just attack each the way they viciously attacking Russia, the way we can win this war. He's talking about long-range missiles in this way and more weapons.
That is remarkably insane to try and make a connection between there. Hamas, Hezbollah are basically guerrilla groups. You know, they're better on the Hezbollah side, but they're still basically non-state actors. They don't have an air force. They don't have air defense. They don't have tanks. They don't have armored personnel carriers. They don't have an industrial capacity. They got none of those things. Russia has all of them. Oh, and this thing called nuclear weapons. And you want to try to make the case that you could just ruthlessly bomb these guys who have none of those things. And you want to do the same thing to the side that has all of those things. I mean, that's irrational to a degree that it's hard for me to imagine he actually wrote that. So there are no correlations between those two. And that even belies the fact that, leading to your point there, that the actual balance of power on the ground is decisively, irrevocably on the Russian side. There is no path. I used to say there's no path to a Ukraine victory ever. Now I'm saying that there's no path to Ukraine to even maintain their lines anymore. It's irrevocable. Russia is going to continue going on, whether they choose the path of the slow, methodical grind, and it may be another year before they finally break through all these places, or if they come in with a big arrow movement and try to, you know, to crush through some of these weakened lines. Both are possible. I don't know enough about the Russian plans. Who does? But I know that both are possible. But that no matter which course they choose, they're going to win the war here. Because Ukraine doesn't have, basically doesn't even have an air force. They have insufficient air defense. Despite all the weird brags about the industrial capacity that Zelensky made earlier today, they don't have a fraction of the total force package that the Russians have across the board that can, you know, make every category of weapon systems that you can have in war. All those things are on the Russian side and they can't be undone. And the Ukraine side can't get them because, well, there's many reasons, but one of the fundamental ones is that the personnel, the troop size, again, same issue that Israel is having, they don't have the manpower to be able to fight an attritional war. They're losing in every capacity. And the losses have been so massive so far that the people that they're now mobilizing in are no disrespect to the humans that are involved here, but in military terms, it's the bottom of the barrel. They're scraping the bottom. These are not people who are going to fight well. And the ones they have been getting for months haven't fought well. So no matter how you want to look at this, I mean, and it's just mind-boggling to me how you have people like Ben Wallace here or Ben Hodges that I've had on my show, a former American general, or David Petraeus, a former CIA director, are all still singing this same ridiculous tune despite all the facts that I just pointed out to you and the physical evidence you have on the battlefield. It just, I just don't get it.
Yeah. Forbes reported that Ukraine has transferred its best tanks to the Kursk region. And what do they want to get from the Kursk region right now? We know that the situation is not in favor of Ukrainians. So we haven't seen, since this attack, this incursion happened, we haven't seen this, any type of winning on the part of Ukrainians. What do they want right now? What would be the strategic meaning of the Kursk region in the eyes of Ukrainians, in your opinion?
There was a theoretical possibility that if you make that incursion, that you can draw away, Russia may have chosen to respond to it by pulling guys off the Eastern Front, the guys who were making a lot of this progress, especially in the Pokrovsk area, some down even in the Zaporizhia, the Toretsk area, and even the Kupiansk direction. Maybe they pull some of those away and it slows or even brings to a standstill something there so they can come and try to help here. But see, here's the thing. It wouldn't matter if Russia had done that. They didn't. And so that's why they've maintained their forward momentum and actually picked up some steam. But it wouldn't have mattered if they had have, because if they had moved those troops over there and they wanted to just eliminate the incursion as fast as they could, like the West probably would have done, they would have succeeded. Because there's only like 10 to sometimes up to 20,000 Ukrainian troops. That's nothing compared to a country of Russia. Obviously, they're going to lose those. So whatever you put in there, you were either going to lose it fast or you're going to lose it slow. And if you lost it slow or if you lost it fast because they moved the troops, then they would move them back over here and continue the assault. And you would have lost these troops. Or they're doing it slow, which they are doing, and you're losing all these troops here and you're still losing fast over here. So there was no possibility of this ever working out in Ukraine's favor. There was a chance for a tactical benefit in one area, but at the cost of another. But instead, it didn't work. the Russians didn't move it over here. It's not slowing down the movements in the east. And now then Russia is content to just let them sit in that pocket and they're methodically just whittling them down. And so they've lost apparently hundreds of armored vehicles of various types and thousands of men. And they have to keep reinforcing them. So now then, not only do you not have those troops to fight the real battle in the east, you also are sending all of this ammunition and weapons and supplies and food and medical support. You have to keep an additional front open up here instead of down here where it's desperately needed. So it is a horrific strategic decision. It never had a chance of success, and it's now proving itself.
And to continue the conflict in Ukraine, we have to have an administration in Ukraine. I'm talking about the Zelensky administration functioning at least. And since this conflict started, we had Zeluzhny getting out. We had the foreign minister of Ukraine getting out of the government. And right now, the head of intelligence. These are very famous people during this conflict.
And the minister of defense, they also fired him.
And yeah, exactly. And we know how there are many disagreements between Zelensky and Syrsky as well in terms of what's going on the battlefield. What's going on, in your opinion, with the Zelensky administration? Is this administration collapsing?
I mean, it's certainly wobbling. I mean, how could it not? Because you're always looking for a scapegoat and you want to blame somebody and you want to try to replace people. And you know, there's probably no shortage of people that are willing to step in next and like, oh yeah, I want that job. That would be cool. But I mean, you see that the core problem is the Zelensky himself, because he's the one that made all the shots. He's the one that left the troops starting in Mariupol too long. And then they lost like 9,000, I think, then instead of withdrawing them out while there was still time. Bakhmut, he kept them in Bakhmut forever. They lost tens of thousands of men they desperately needed for their offensive, and they didn't have them. Then Avdiivka after that, Vuhledar, just a little while ago, there's several of the pockets. I mean, I could go on and on this issue here. He's the one that gave all those orders. It was his decision to launch this offensive in 2023 when they didn't have anywhere near, well, they didn't have any air power. They didn't have enough air defense. They didn't have enough armor. They didn't have enough training to understand how to do it. They weren't equipped. They didn't have enough ammunition. They had none of the things that you need to have an offensive. He gave the order anyway. All these orders came from Zelensky. All these ministers were placed by Zelensky. All of them were fired by Zelensky. You see the common thread here. It all goes back to one man. And as long as he's in charge and calling the shots and everybody else does it, these terrible decisions are going to continue to be made.
Colonel, do you feel that Germany is changing its mind toward Russia?
Yeah, it certainly looks like it. I mean, you've had for several months now where Olaf Scholz has been making more and more conciliatory comments and you know, and adamantly said, no, none of our long-range missiles are going to be used by Ukraine into Russia, period. I mean, he was firm on that. Now he's saying, you know what, it's probably time to talk, and maybe you might have to give away some land to get some peace. You know, and that's on top of you know, the prime minister of Hungary or Slovakia or Erdogan down in Turkey. So you see the numbers are growing because people recognize it. I mean, this victory narrative that the US and the UK especially are the biggest cheerleaders for, and probably you can put in Macron from France as well into that category. But the rest of them are kind of going, this is stupid. I mean, they see what we see. They have more information and knowledge than I do. They know that this isn't going to work. And I think that you're going to see more fracturing of the unity of NATO the longer this goes, and especially if you see one of these days where the Ukrainian army finally breaks and buckles somewhere and a big chunk of the defense just falls apart, I think there'll be more people willing to say, okay, that's it. We gave it every chance we could. Now it's time to make a deal. You give away whatever you have to get this over because we're done. I think that's probably the most likely outcome.
Yeah. Thank you so much for being with us today. Great pleasure, as always.
You bet. Thanks for having me on there. Always appreciate it.
My pleasure.